embryonic processes, and hence in, say, behaviour. For instance, a mutant gene in birds for brotherly altruism will certainly not be solely responsible for an entirely new complicated behaviour pattern. Instead, it will alter some already existing and probably already complicated behaviour pattern. The most likely precursor in this case is parental behaviour. Birds routinely have the complicated nervous apparatus needed to feed and care for their own offspring. This has, in turn, been built up over many generations of slow, step-by-step evolution from antecedents of its own. Incidentally, skeptics about genes for fraternal care are often inconsistent. Why aren't they just as skeptical about genes for equally complicated parental care? The pre-existing behaviour pattern, parental care in this case, will be mediated by a convenient rule of thumb, such as feed all squawking, gaping things in the nest. The gene for feeding younger brothers and sisters could work then by accelerating the age at which this rule of thumb matures in development. A fledgling bearing the fraternal gene as a new mutation will simply activate its parental rule of thumb a little earlier than a normal bird. It will treat the squawking, gaping things in its parents' nest, its younger brothers and sisters, as if they were squawking, gaping things in its own nest, its children. Far from being a brand new complicated behavioural innovation, fraternal behaviour would originally arise as a slight variant in the developmental timing of already existing behaviour. As so often, fallacies arise when we forget the essential gradualism of evolution, the fact that adaptive evolution proceeds by small, step-by-step alterations of pre-existing structures or behaviour.
Is there any experimental evidence for the genetic inheritance of altruistic behaviour? No, but that is hardly surprising, since little work has been done on the genetics of any behaviour. Instead, let's look at one study of a behaviour pattern which does not happen to be obviously altruistic, but which is complex enough to be interesting. It serves as a model for how altruistic behaviour might be inherited.
Honeybees suffer from an infectious disease called foul brood. This attacks the grubs in their cells. Of the domestic breeds used by beekeepers, some are more at risk from foul brood than others, and it turns out that the difference between strains is, at least in some cases, a behavioural one. There are so-called hygienic strains, which quickly stamp out epidemics by locating infected grubs, pulling them from their cells, and throwing them out of the hive. The susceptible strains are susceptible because they do not practice this hygienic infanticide. The behaviour actually involved in hygiene is quite complicated. The workers have to locate the cell of each diseased grub, remove the wax cap from the cell, pull out the larva, drag it through the door of the hive, and throw it on the rubbish tip. Doing genetic experiments with bees is quite a complicated business for various reasons. Worker bees themselves do not ordinarily reproduce, and so you have to cross a queen of one strain with a drone, male, of the other. And then look at the behaviour of the daughter workers. This is what W.C. Rotenbuehler did. He found that all first-generation hybrid daughter hives were non-hygienic. The behaviour of their hygienic parent seemed to have been lost, although as things turned out, the hygienic genes were still there, but were recessive, like human genes for blue eyes.
When Rotenbuehler back-crossed first-generation hybrids with a pure hygienic strain, again, of course, using queens and drones, he obtained a most beautiful result. The daughter hives fell into three groups. One group showed perfect hygienic behaviour, a second showed no hygienic behaviour at all, and the third went halfway. This last group uncapped the wax cells of diseased grubs, but they did not follow through and throw out the larvae. Rotenbuehler surmised that there might be two separate genes, one gene for uncapping and one gene for throwing out. Normal hygienic strains possess both genes, susceptible strains possess the alleles, rivals, of both genes instead. The hybrids who only went halfway presumably possessed the uncapping gene, in double dose, but not the throwing-out gene. Rotenbuehler guessed that his experimental group of apparently totally non-hygienic bees might conceal a subgroup possessing the throwing-out gene, but unable to show it because they lacked the uncapping gene. He confirmed this most elegantly by removing caps himself. Sure enough, half of the apparently non-hygienic bees thereupon showed perfectly normal throwing-out behaviour.
End note. If the original edition of The Selfish Gene had had footnotes, one of them would have been devoted to explaining, as Rothenbühler himself scrupulously did, that the bee results were not quite so neat and tidy. Out of the many colonies that, according to theory, should not have shown hygienic behaviour, one nevertheless did. In Rothenbühler's own words, "We cannot disregard this result regardless of how much we would like to, but we are basing the genetic hypothesis on the other data." A mutation in the anomalous colony is a possible explanation, though it is not very likely.
This story illustrates a number of important points which came up in the previous chapter. It shows that it can be perfectly proper to speak of a gene for behaviour so-and-so, even if we haven't the faintest idea of the chemical chain of embryonic causes leading from gene to behaviour. The chain of causes could even turn out to involve learning. For example, it could be that the uncapping gene exerts its effect by giving bees a taste for infected wax. This means they will find the eating of the wax caps covering disease victims rewarding and will therefore tend to repeat it. Even if this is how the gene works, it is still truly a gene for uncapping, provided that, other things being equal, bees possessing the gene end up by uncapping and bees not possessing the gene do not uncap. Secondly, it illustrates the fact that genes cooperate in their effects on the behaviour of the communal survival machine. The throwing-out gene is useless unless it is accompanied by the uncapping gene, and vice versa. Yet the genetic experiments show equally clearly that the two genes are in principle quite separable in their journey through the generations. As far as their useful work is concerned, you can think of them as a single cooperating unit, but as replicating genes, they are two free and independent agents.
For purposes of argument, it will be necessary to speculate about genes for doing all sorts of improbable things. If I speak, for example, of a hypothetical gene for saving companions from drowning, and you find such a concept incredible, remember the story of the hygienic bees. Recall that we are not talking about the gene as the sole antecedent cause of all the complex muscular contractions, sensory integrations, and even conscious decisions that are involved in saving somebody from drowning. We are saying nothing about the question of whether learning, experience, or environmental influences enter into the development of the behaviour. All you have to concede is that it is possible for a single gene, other things being equal, and lots of other essential genes and environmental factors being present, to make a body more likely to save somebody from drowning than its allele would. The difference between the two genes may turn out at bottom to be a slight difference in some simple quantitative variable. The details of the embryonic developmental process, interesting as they may be, are irrelevant to evolutionary considerations. The genes are master programmers, and they are programming for their lives. They are judged according to the success of their programs in coping with all the hazards that life throws at their survival machines, and the judge is the ruthless judge of the court of survival. We shall come later to ways in which gene survival can be fostered by what appears to be altruistic behaviour. But the obvious first priorities of a survival machine, and of the brain that takes the decisions for it, are individual survival and reproduction. All the genes in the colony would agree about these priorities. Animals therefore go to elaborate lengths to find and catch food, to avoid being caught and eaten themselves, to avoid disease and accident, to protect themselves from unfavourable climatic conditions, to find members of the opposite sex and persuade them to mate, and to confer on their children advantages similar to those they enjoy themselves. I shall not give examples. If you want one, just look carefully at the next wild animal that you see. But I do want to mention one particular kind of behaviour, because we shall need to refer to it again when we come to speak of altruism and selfishness. This is the behaviour that can be broadly labelled communication. A survival machine may be said to have communicated with another one when it influences its behavior or the state of its nervous system. This is not a definition I should like to have to defend for very long, but it is good enough for present purposes. By influence, I mean direct causal influence. Examples of communication are numerous: song in birds, frogs and crickets, tail wagging and hackle raising in dogs, grinning in chimpanzees, human gestures and language. A great number of survival machine actions promote their genes' welfare indirectly by influencing the behavior of other survival machines. Animals go to great lengths to make this communication effective. The songs of birds enchant and mystify successive generations of men. I have already referred to the even more elaborate and mysterious song of the humpback whale, with its prodigious range, its frequencies spanning the whole of human hearing, from subsonic rumblings to ultrasonic squeaks. Mole crickets amplify their songs to stentorian loudness by singing down in a burrow, which they carefully dig in the shape of a double exponential horn or megaphone. Bees dance in the dark to give other bees accurate information about the direction and distance of food, a feat of communication rivaled only by human language itself.
The traditional story of ethologists is that communication signals evolve for the mutual benefit of both sender and recipient. For instance, baby chicks influence their mother's behavior by giving high, piercing cheeps when they're lost or cold. This usually has the immediate effect of summoning the mother, who leads the chick back to the main clutch. This behavior could be said to have evolved for mutual benefit, in the sense that natural selection has favored babies that cheep when they are lost, and also mothers that respond appropriately to the cheeping. If we wish to, it's not really necessary, we can regard signals such as the cheep call as having a meaning or as carrying information. In this case, I am lost. The alarm call given by small birds mentioned in Chapter 1 could be said to convey the information, there is a hawk. Animals who receive this information and act on it are benefited. Therefore, the information can be said to be true. But do animals ever communicate false information? Do they ever tell lies?
The notion of an animal telling a lie is open to misunderstanding, so I must try to forestall this. I remember attending a lecture given by Beatrice and Alan Gardner about their famous talking chimpanzee, Washo. She uses American Sign Language, and her achievement is of great potential interest to students of language. There were some philosophers in the audience, and in the discussion after the lecture, they were much exercised by the question of whether Washo could tell a lie. I suspected that the Gardners thought there were more interesting things to talk about, and I agreed with them. In this book, I am using words like deceive and lie in a much more straightforward sense than those philosophers. They were interested in conscious intention to deceive. I am talking simply about having an effect functionally equivalent to deception. If a bird used the there is a hawk signal when there was no hawk, thereby frightening his colleagues away, leaving him to eat all their food, we might say he had told a lie. We would not mean he had deliberately intended consciously to deceive. All that is implied is that the liar gained food at the other bird's expense, and the reason the other birds flew away was that they reacted to the liar's cry in a way appropriate to the presence of a hawk. Many edible insects, like the butterflies of the previous chapter, derive protection by mimicking the external appearance of other distasteful or stinging insects. We ourselves are often fooled into thinking that yellow and black striped hoverflies are wasps. Some bee-mimicking flies are even more perfect in their deception. Predators, too, tell lies. Anglerfish wait patiently on the bottom of the sea, blending in with the background. The only conspicuous part is a wriggling worm-like piece of flesh on the end of a long fishing rod, projecting from the top of the head. When a small prey fish comes near, the angler will dance its worm-like bait in front of the little fish and lure it down to the region of the angler's own concealed mouth. Suddenly, it opens its jaws and the little fish is sucked in and eaten. The angler is telling a lie, exploiting the little fish's tendency to approach wriggling worm-like objects. He is saying, here is a worm. and any little fish who believes the lie is quickly eaten.
Some survival machines exploit the sexual desires of others. Bee orchids induce bees to copulate with their flowers because of their strong resemblance to female bees. What the orchid has to gain from this deception is pollination, for a bee who is fooled by two orchids will, incidentally, carry pollen from one to the other. Fireflies, which are really beetles, attract their mates by flashing lights at them. Each species has its own particular dot-dash flashing pattern, which prevents confusion between species and consequent harmful hybridization. Just as sailors look out for the flash patterns of particular lighthouses, so fireflies seek the coded flash patterns of their own species. Females of the genus Photurus have discovered that they can lure males of the genus Photinus if they imitate the flashing code of a Photinus female. This they do, and when a Photinus male is fooled by the lie into approaching, he is summarily eaten by the Photurus female. Sirens and Lorelei spring to mind as analogies, but Cornishmen will prefer to think of the wreckers of the old days, who used lanterns to lure ships onto the rocks and then plundered the cargoes that spilled out of the wrecks. Whenever a system of communication evolves, there is always the danger that some will exploit the system for their own ends. Brought up as we have been on the good of the species view of evolution, we naturally think first of liars and deceivers as belonging to different species, predators, prey, parasites, and so on. However, we must expect lies and deceit and selfish exploitation of communication to arise whenever the interests of the genes of different individuals diverge. This will include individuals of the same species. As we shall see, we must even expect that children will deceive their parents, that husbands will cheat on wives, and that brother will lie to brother. Even the belief that animal communication signals originally evolve to foster mutual benefit and then afterwards become exploited by malevolent parties is too simple. It may well be that all animal communication contains an element of deception right from the start, because all animal interactions involve at least some conflict of interest. The next chapter introduces a powerful way of thinking about conflicts of interest from an evolutionary point of view.
End note. I now find myself dissatisfied with my original treatment of animal communication. John Krebs and I have argued in two articles that most animal signals are best seen as neither informative nor deceptive, but rather as manipulative. A signal is a means by which one animal makes use of another animal's muscle power. A nightingale's song is not information, not even deceitful information. It is persuasive, hypnotic, spellbinding oratory. This kind of argument is taken to its logical conclusion in The Extended Phenotype, part of which I have abridged in Chapter 13 of this book. Krebs and I argued that signals evolve from an interplay of what we called mind-reading and manipulation. A startlingly different approach to the whole matter of animal signals is that of Amos Zahavi. In a note to Chapter 9, I discuss Zahavi's views far more sympathetically than in the first edition of this book.
Chapter 5. Aggression, Stability and the Selfish Machine. This chapter is mostly about the much misunderstood topic of aggression. We shall continue to treat the individual as a selfish machine, programmed to do whatever is best for its genes as a whole. This is the language of convenience. At the end of the chapter, we return to the language of single genes. To a survival machine, another survival machine, which is not its own child or another close relative, is part of its environment, like a rock or a river or a lump of food. It is something that gets in the way, or something that can be exploited. It differs from a rock or a river in one important respect. It is inclined to hit back. This is because it too is a machine that holds its immortal genes in trust for the future, and it too will stop at nothing to preserve them. Natural selection favors genes that control their survival machines in such a way that they make the best use of their environment. This includes making the best use of other survival machines, both of the same and of different species.
In some cases, survival machines seem to impinge rather little on each other's lives. For instance, moles and blackbirds do not eat each other, mate with each other, or compete with each other for living space. Even so, we must not treat them as completely insulated. They may compete for something, perhaps earthworms. This does not mean you will ever see a mole and a blackbird engaged in a tug of war over a worm. Indeed, a blackbird may never set eyes on a mole in its life. But if you wiped out the population of moles, the effect on blackbirds might be dramatic, although I could not hazard a guess as to what the details might be, nor by what tortuously indirect routes the influence might travel. Survival machines of different species influence each other in a variety of ways. They may be predators or prey, parasites or hosts, competitors for some scarce resource. They may be exploited in special ways, as for instance when bees are used as pollen carriers by flowers. Survival machines of the same species tend to impinge on each other's lives more directly. This is for many reasons. One is that half the population of one's own species may be potential mates and potentially hard-working and exploitable parents to one's children. Another reason is that members of the same species, being very similar to each other, being machines for preserving genes in the same kind of place with the same kind of way of life, are particularly direct competitors for all the resources necessary for life. To a blackbird, a mole may be a competitor, but it is not nearly so important a competitor as another blackbird. Moles and blackbirds may compete for worms, but blackbirds and blackbirds compete with each other for worms and for everything else. If they are members of the same sex, they may also compete for mating partners. For reasons that we shall see, it is usually the males who compete with each other for females. This means that a male might benefit his own genes if he does something detrimental to another male with whom he is competing.
The logical policy for a survival machine might therefore seem to be to murder its rivals and then, preferably, to eat them. Although murder and cannibalism do occur in nature, they're not as common as a naive interpretation of the selfish gene theory might predict. Indeed, Conrad Lawrence, in his book On Aggression, stresses the restrained and gentlemanly nature of animal fighting. For him, the notable thing about animal fights is that they are formal tournaments, played according to rules like those of boxing or fencing. Animals fight with gloved fists and blunted foils. Threat and bluff take the place of deadly earnest. Gestures of surrender are recognized by victors, who then refrain from dealing the killing blow or bite that our naive theory might predict. This interpretation of animal aggression as being restrained and formal can be disputed. In particular, it is certainly wrong to condemn poor old Homo sapiens as the only species to kill his own kind, the only inheritor of the mark of Cain, and similar melodramatic charges. Whether a naturalist stresses the violence or the restraint of animal aggression depends partly on the kinds of animals he is used to watching, and partly on his evolutionary preconceptions. Lawrence is, after all, a good-of-the-species man. Even if it has been exaggerated, the gloved-fist view of animal fights seems to have at least some truth. Superficially, this looks like a form of altruism. The selfish gene theory must face up to the difficult task of explaining it. Why is it that animals do not go all out to kill rival members of their species at every possible opportunity? The general answer to this is that there are costs as well as benefits resulting from outright pugnacity, and not only the obvious costs in time and energy. For instance, suppose that B and C are both my rivals, and I happen to meet B. It might seem sensible for me, as a selfish individual, to try to kill him. But wait. C is also my rival, and C is also B's rival. By killing B, I'm potentially doing a good turn to C by removing one of his rivals. I might have done better to let B live, because he might then have competed or fought with C, thereby benefiting me indirectly. The moral of this simple hypothetical example is that there is no obvious merit in indiscriminately trying to kill rivals. In a large and complex system of rivalries, removing one rival from the scene does not necessarily do any good. Other rivals may be more likely to benefit from his death than oneself. This is the kind of hard lesson that has been learned by pest control officers. You have a serious agricultural pest, you discover a good way to exterminate it, and you gleefully do so, only to find that another pest benefits from the extermination even more than human agriculture does, and you end up worse off than you were before.
On the other hand, it might seem a good plan to kill, or at least fight with, certain particular rivals in a discriminating way. If B is an elephant seal in possession of a large harem full of females, and if I, another elephant seal, can acquire his harem by killing him, I might be well advised to attempt to do so. But there are costs and risks even in selective pugnacity. It is to B's advantage to fight back, to defend his valuable property. If I start a fight, I am just as likely to end up dead as he is. Perhaps even more so, he holds a valuable resource, that is why I want to fight him. But why does he hold it? Perhaps he won it in combat. He has probably beaten off other challengers before me. He is probably a good fighter. Even if I win the fight and gain the harem, I may be so badly mauled in the process that I cannot enjoy the benefits. Also, fighting uses up time and energy. These might be better conserved for the time being. If I concentrate on feeding and on keeping out of trouble for a time, I shall grow bigger and stronger. I'll fight him for the harem in the end, but I may have a better chance of winning eventually if I wait rather than rush in now. This subjective soliloquy is just a way of pointing out that the decision, whether or not to fight, should ideally be preceded by a complex, if unconscious, cost-benefit calculation. The potential benefits are not all stacked up on the side of fighting, although undoubtedly some of them are. Similarly, during a fight, each tactical decision over whether to escalate the fight or cool it has costs and benefits which could, in principle, be analysed. This has long been recognised by ethologists in a vague sort of way, but it has taken J. Maynard Smith, not normally regarded as an ethologist, to express the idea forcefully and clearly. In collaboration with G.R. Price and G.A. Parker, he uses the branch of mathematics known as game theory. Their elegant ideas can be expressed in words without mathematical symbols, albeit at some cost in rigour.
The essential concept Maynard Smith introduces is that of the evolutionarily stable strategy, an idea that he traces back to W.D. Hamilton and R.H. MacArthur. A strategy is a pre-programmed behavioural policy. An example of a strategy is attack opponent. If he flees, pursue him. If he retaliates, run away. It is important to realise that we're not thinking of the strategy as being consciously worked out by the individual. Remember that we are picturing the animal as a robot survival machine with a pre-programmed computer controlling the muscles. To write the strategy out as a set of simple instructions in English is just a convenient way for us to think about it. By some unspecified mechanism, the animal behaves as if he were following these instructions. An evolutionarily stable strategy, or ESS, is defined as a strategy which, if most members of a population adopt it, cannot be bettered by an alternative strategy. It is a subtle and important idea. Another way of putting it is to say that the best strategy for an individual depends on what the majority of the population are doing. Since the rest of the population consists of individuals, each one trying to maximize his own success, the only strategy that persists will be one which, once evolved, cannot be bettered by any deviant individual. Following a major environmental change, there may be a brief period of evolutionary instability, perhaps even oscillation in the population. But once an ESS is achieved, it will stay. Selection will penalise deviation from it.
End note. I now like to express the essential idea of an ESS in the following more economical way. An ESS is a strategy that does well against copies of itself. The rationale for this is as follows. A successful strategy is one that dominates the population. Therefore, it will tend to encounter copies of itself. Therefore, it won't stay successful unless it does well against copies of itself. This definition is not so mathematically precise as Maynard Smith's, and it cannot replace his definition because it is actually incomplete. But it does have the virtue of encapsulating, intuitively, the basic ESS idea. The ESS way of thinking has become more widespread among biologists now than when this chapter was written. Maynard Smith himself summarized developments up to 1982 in his book Evolution and the Theory of Games. Robert Axelrod's The Evolution of Cooperation makes use of ESS theory, but I won't discuss it here since one of my two new chapters, Nice Guys Finish First, is largely devoted to explaining Axelrod's work. My own writings on the subject of ESS theory since the first edition of this book are an article called Good Strategy or Evolutionarily Stable Strategy and the joint papers on digger wasps, discussed later.
To apply this idea to aggression, consider one of Maynard Smith's simplest hypothetical cases. Suppose that there are only two sorts of fighting strategy in a population of a particular species named hawk and dove. The names refer to conventional human usage and have no connection with the habits of the birds from whom the names are derived. Doves are in fact rather aggressive birds. Any individual of our hypothetical population is classified as a hawk or a dove. Hawks always fight as hard and as unrestrainedly as they can, retreating only when seriously injured. Doves merely threaten in a dignified, conventional way, never hurting anybody. If a hawk fights a dove, the dove quickly runs away and so does not get hurt. If a hawk fights a hawk, they go on until one of them is seriously injured or dead. If a dove meets a dove, nobody gets hurt. They go on posturing at each other for a long time until one of them tires or decides not to bother anymore and therefore backs down. For the time being, we assume that there is no way in which an individual can tell in advance whether a particular rival is a hawk or a dove. He only discovers this by fighting him, and he has no memory of past fights with particular individuals to guide him. Now, as a purely arbitrary convention, we allot contestants points. Say 50 points for a win, 0 for losing, minus 100 for being seriously injured, and minus 10 for wasting time over a long contest. These points can be thought of as being directly convertible into the currency of gene survival. An individual who scores high points, who has a high average payoff, is an individual who leaves many genes behind him in the gene pool. Within broad limits, the actual numerical values do not matter for the analysis, but they help us to think about the problem. The important thing is, we are not interested in whether hawks will tend to beat doves when they fight them. We already know the answer to that. Hawks will always win. We want to know whether either hawk or dove is an evolutionarily stable strategy. If one of them is an ESS and the other is not, we must expect that the one which is the ESS will evolve. It's theoretically possible for there to be two ESSs. This would be true if, whatever the majority strategy of the population happened to be, whether hawk or dove, the best strategy for any given individual was to follow suit. In this case, the population would tend to stick at whichever one of its two stable states it happened to reach first. However, as we shall now see, neither of these two strategies, hawk or dove, would in fact be evolutionarily stable on its own, and we should therefore not expect either of them to evolve. To show this, we must calculate average payoffs.
Suppose we have a population consisting entirely of doves. Whenever they fight, nobody gets hurt. The contests consist of prolonged ritual tournaments, staring matches perhaps, which end only when one rival backs down. The winner then scores 50 points for gaining the resource in dispute, but he pays a penalty of minus 10 for wasting time over a long staring match, so scores 40 in all. The loser also is penalized minus 10 points for wasting time. On average, any one individual dove can expect to win half his contests and lose half. Therefore, his average payoff per contest is halfway between plus 40 and minus 10, which is plus 15. Therefore, every individual dove in a population of doves seems to be doing quite nicely. But now suppose a mutant hawk arises in the population. Since he is the only hawk around, every fight he has is against a dove. Hawks always beat doves, so he scores plus 50 every fight, and this is his average payoff. He enjoys an enormous advantage over the doves, whose net payoff is only plus 15. Hawk genes will rapidly spread through the population as a result. But now, each hawk can no longer count on every rival he meets being a dove. To take an extreme example, if the hawk gene spread so successfully that the entire population came to consist of hawks, all fights would now be hawk fights. Things are now very different. When hawk meets hawk, one of them is seriously injured, scoring minus 100, while the winner scores plus 50. Each hawk in a population of hawks can expect to win half his fights and lose half his fights. His average expected payoff per fight is therefore halfway between plus 50 and minus 100, which is minus 25. Now consider a single dove in a population of hawks. To be sure, he loses all his fights, but on the other hand, he never gets hurt. His average payoff is zero in a population of hawks, whereas the average payoff for a hawk in a population of hawks is minus 25. Dove genes will therefore tend to spread through the population. The way I have told the story, it looks as if there will be a continuous oscillation in the population. Hawk genes will sweep to ascendancy. Then, as a consequence of the hawk majority, dove genes will gain an advantage and increase in numbers, until once again hawk genes start to prosper, and so on. However, it need not be an oscillation like this. There will be a stable ratio of hawks to doves. For the particular arbitrary point system we are using, the stable ratio, if you work it out, turns out to be 5/12 doves to 7/12 hawks. When this stable ratio is reached, the average payoff for hawks is exactly equal to the average payoff for doves. Therefore, selection does not favour either one of them over the other. If the number of hawks in the population started to drift upwards, so that the ratio was no longer 7/12, doves would start to gain an extra advantage, and the ratio would swing back to the stable state. Just as we shall find the stable sex ratio to be 50-50, so the stable hawk-to-dove ratio, in this hypothetical example, is 7/5. In either case, if there are oscillations about the stable point, they need not be very large ones. Superficially, this sounds a little like group selection, but it is really nothing of the kind. It sounds like group selection because it enables us to think of a population as having a stable equilibrium to which it tends to return when disturbed. But the ESS is a much more subtle concept than group selection. It has nothing to do with some groups being more successful than others. This can be nicely illustrated using the arbitrary point system of our hypothetical example. The average payoff to an individual in a stable population consisting of 7/12 hawks and 5/12 doves turns out to be 6.25. This is true whether the individual is a hawk or a dove. Now, 6.25 is much less than the average payoff for a dove in a population of doves, plus 15. If only everybody would agree to be a dove, every single individual would benefit. By simple group selection, any group in which all individuals mutually agree to be doves would be far more successful than a rival group sitting at the ESS ratio. As a matter of fact, a conspiracy of nothing but doves is not quite the most successful possible group. In a group consisting of 1/6 hawks and 5/6 doves, the average payoff per contest is 16 2/3. This is the most successful possible conspiracy, but for present purposes we can ignore it. A simpler all-dove conspiracy, with its average payoff for each individual of plus 15, is far better for every single individual than the ESS would be. Group selection theory would therefore predict a tendency to evolve towards an all-dove conspiracy, since a group that contained a 7/12 proportion of hawks would be less successful. But the trouble with conspiracies, even those that are to everybody's advantage in the long run, is that they are open to abuse. It is true that everybody does better in an all-dove group than he would in an ESS group. But unfortunately, in conspiracies of doves, a single hawk does so extremely well that nothing could stop the evolution of hawks. The conspiracy is therefore bound to be broken by treachery from within. An ESS is stable, not because it is particularly good for the individuals participating in it, but simply because it is immune to treachery from within.
It is possible for humans to enter into pacts or conspiracies that are every individual's advantage, even if these are not stable in the ESS sense. But this is only possible because every individual uses his conscious foresight and is able to see that it is in his own long-term interests to obey the rules of the pact. Even in human pacts, there is a constant danger that individuals will stand to gain so much in the short term by breaking the pact that the temptation to do so will be overwhelming. Perhaps the best example of this is price fixing. It is in the long-term interests of all individual garage owners to standardize the price of petrol at some artificially high value. Price rings, based on conscious estimation of long-term best interests, can survive for quite long periods. Every so often, however, an individual gives in to the temptation to make a quick killing by cutting his prices. Immediately, his neighbours follow suit, and a wave of price cutting spreads over the country. Unfortunately for the rest of us, the conscious foresight of the garage owners then reasserts itself, and they enter into a new price-fixing pact. So even in man, a species with the gift of conscious foresight, pacts or conspiracies based on long-term best interests teeter constantly on the brink of collapse due to treachery from within. In wild animals, controlled by the struggling genes, it is even more difficult to see ways in which group benefit or conspiracy strategies could possibly evolve. We must expect to find evolutionarily stable strategies everywhere. In our hypothetical example, we made the simple assumption that any one individual was either a hawk or a dove. We ended up with an evolutionarily stable ratio of hawks to doves. In practice, what this means is that a stable ratio of hawk genes to dove genes would be achieved in the gene pool. The genetic technical term for this state is stable polymorphism. As far as the maths are concerned, an exactly equivalent ESS can be achieved without polymorphism as follows.
If every individual is capable of behaving either like a hawk or like a dove in each particular contest, an ESS can be achieved in which all individuals have the same probability of behaving like a hawk, namely 7/12 in our particular example. In practice, this would mean that each individual enters each contest having made a random decision whether to behave on this occasion like a hawk or like a dove. Random, but with a 7/5 bias in favour of hawk. It is very important that the decisions, although biased towards hawk, should be random in the sense that a rival has no way of guessing how his opponent is going to behave in any particular contest. It is no good, for instance, playing hawk 7 fights in a row, then dove 5 fights in a row, and so on. If any individual adopted such a simple sequence, his rivals would quickly catch on and take advantage. The way to take advantage of a simple sequence strategist is to play hawk against him only when you know he's going to play dove. The hawk and dove story is, of course, naively simple. It is a model, something that does not really happen in nature, but which helps us to understand things that do happen in nature. Models can be very simple, like this one, and still be useful for understanding a point or getting an idea. Simple models can be elaborated and gradually made more complex. If all goes well, as they get more complex, they come to resemble the real world more. One way in which we can begin to develop the hawk and dove model is to introduce some more strategies. Hawk and dove are not the only possibilities. A more complex strategy, which Maynard Smith and Price introduced, is called retaliator. A retaliator plays like a dove at the beginning of every fight. That is, he does not mount an all-out savage attack like a hawk, but has a conventional threatening match. If his opponent attacks him, however, he retaliates. In other words, a retaliator behaves like a hawk when he is attacked by a hawk, and like a dove when he meets a dove. when he meets another retaliator, he plays like a dove. A retaliator is a conditional strategist. His behaviour depends on the behaviour of his opponent.
Another conditional strategist is called bully. A bully goes around behaving like a hawk until somebody hits back. Then he immediately runs away. Yet another conditional strategist is proba retaliator. A proba retaliator is basically like a retaliator, but he occasionally tries a brief experimental escalation of the contest. He persists in this hawk-like behaviour if his opponent does not fight back. If, on the other hand, his opponent does fight back, he reverts to conventional threatening like a dove. If he is attacked, he retaliates just like an ordinary retaliator. If all the five strategies mentioned are turned loose upon one another in a computer simulation, only one of them, retaliator, emerges as evolutionarily stable. Proba retaliator is nearly stable. Dove is not stable because a population of doves would be invaded by hawks and bullies. Hawk is not stable because a population of hawks would be invaded by doves and bullies. Bully is not stable because a population of bullies would be invaded by hawks. In a population of retaliators, no other strategy would invade, since there's no other strategy that does better than retaliator itself. However, dove does equally well in a population of retaliators. This means that, other things being equal, the numbers of doves could slowly drift upwards. Now, if the numbers of doves drifted up to any significant extent, proba retaliators, and incidentally hawks and bullies, would start to have an advantage, since they do better against doves than retaliators do. Proba retaliator itself, unlike hawk and bully, is almost an ESS in the sense that, in a population of proba retaliators, only one other strategy, retaliator, does better, and then only slightly. We might expect, therefore, that a mixture of retaliators and proba retaliators would tend to predominate, with perhaps even a gentle oscillation between the two, in association with an oscillation in the size of a small dove minority.
End note. Unfortunately, there was a minor error in the original Maynard Smith and Price paper, and I repeated it in this chapter, even exacerbating it by making the rather foolish statement that proba retaliator is almost an ESS. If a strategy is almost an ESS, then it is not an ESS and will be invaded. Retaliator looks superficially like an ESS because, in a population of retaliators, no other strategy does better. But dove does equally well since, in a population of retaliators, it is indistinguishable in its behaviour from retaliator. Dove, therefore, can drift into the population. It is what happens next that is the problem. J.S. Gale and the Reverend L.J. Eaves did a dynamic computer simulation in which they took a population of model animals through a large number of generations of evolution. They showed that the true ESS in this game is, in fact, a stable mixture of hawks and bullies. This is not the only error in the early ESS literature that has been exposed by dynamic treatment of this type. Another nice example is an error of my own, discussed in my notes to Chapter 9.
But back to the theory. We don't have to think in terms of a polymorphism in which every individual always plays one strategy or another. Each individual could play a complex mixture between retaliator, proba retaliator, and dove. This theoretical conclusion is not far from what actually happens in most wild animals. We have, in a sense, explained the gloved fist aspect of animal aggression. Of course, the details depend on the exact numbers of points awarded for winning, being injured, wasting time, and so on. In elephant seals, the prize for winning may be near monopoly rights over a large harem of females. The payoff for winning must therefore be rated as very high. Small wonder that fights are vicious and the probability of serious injury is also high. The cost of wasting time should presumably be regarded as small in comparison with the cost of being injured and the benefit of winning. For a small bird in a cold climate, on the other hand, the cost of wasting time may be paramount. A great tit, when feeding nestlings, needs to catch an average of one prey per 30 seconds. Every second of daylight is precious. Even the comparatively short time wasted in a hawk-hawk fight should perhaps be regarded as more serious than the risk of injury to such a bird. Unfortunately, we know too little at present to assign realistic numbers to the costs and benefits of various outcomes in nature.
End note. Since that passage was written, there have been some good field measurements of costs and benefits in nature, which have been plugged into particular ESS models. One of the best examples comes from great golden digger wasps in North America. Digger wasps are not the familiar social wasps of our autumn jam pots, which are neuter females working for a colony. Each female digger wasp is on her own, and she devotes her life to providing shelter and food for a succession of her larvae. Typically, a female begins by digging a long borehole into the earth, at the bottom of which is a hollowed-out chamber. She then sets off to hunt prey, katydids or longhorn grasshoppers in the case of the great golden digger wasp. When she finds one, she stings it to paralyze it and drags it back to her burrow. Having accumulated 4 or 5 katydids, she lays an egg on top of the pile and seals up the burrow. The egg hatches into a larva, which feeds on the katydids. The point about the prey being paralyzed rather than killed, by the way, is that they don't decay but are eaten alive and therefore fresh. It was this macabre habit in the related ichneumon wasps that provoked Darwin to write, "I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars." He could equally have used the example of a chef boiling lobsters alive to preserve the flavour. Returning to the life of the female digger wasp, it is a solitary one, except that other females are working independently in the same area, and sometimes they occupy one another's burrows, rather than go to the trouble of digging a new one. Dr. Jane Brockman is a sort of wasp equivalent of Jane Goodall. She came from America to work with me at Oxford, bringing her copious records of almost every event in the life of 2 entire populations of individually identified female wasps. These records were so complete that individual wasp time budgets could be drawn up. Time is an economic commodity. The more time spent on one part of life, the less is available for other parts. Alan Graffin joined the two of us and taught us how to think correctly about time costs and reproductive benefits. We found evidence for a true mixed ESS in a game played between female wasps in a population in New Hampshire, though we failed to find such evidence in another population in Michigan. Briefly, the New Hampshire wasps either dig their own nests or enter a nest that another wasp has dug. According to our interpretation, wasps can benefit by entering because some nests are abandoned by their original diggers and are reusable. It does not pay to enter a nest that is occupied, but an enterer has no way of knowing which nests are occupied and which abandoned. She runs the risk of going for days in double occupation, at the end of which she may come home to find the burrow sealed up and all her efforts in vain. The other occupant has laid her egg and will reap the benefits. If too much entering is going on in a population, available burrows become scarce, the chance of double occupation goes up, and it therefore pays to dig. Conversely, if plenty of wasps are digging, the high availability of burrows favours entering. There is a critical frequency of entering in the population at which digging and entering are equally profitable. If the actual frequency is below the critical frequency, natural selection favours entering, because there is a good supply of available abandoned burrows. If the actual frequency is higher than the critical frequency, there is a shortage of available burrows, and natural selection favours digging. So a balance is maintained in the population. The detailed quantitative evidence suggests that this is a true mixed ESS, each individual wasp having a probability of digging or entering, rather than the population containing a mixture of digging and entering specialists.
We must be careful not to draw conclusions that result simply from our own arbitrary choice of numbers. The general conclusions, which are important, are that ESSs will tend to evolve, that an ESS is not the same as the optimum that could be achieved by a group conspiracy and that common sense can be misleading. Another kind of war game that Maynard Smith has considered is the war of attrition. This can be thought of as arising in a species that never engages in dangerous combat, perhaps a well-armoured species in which injury is very unlikely. All disputes in this species are settled by conventional posturing. A contest always ends in one rival or the other backing down. To win, all you have to do is stand your ground and glare at the opponent until he finally turns tail. Obviously, no animal can afford to spend infinite time threatening. There are important things to be done elsewhere. The resource he is competing for may be valuable, but it's not infinitely valuable. It's only worth so much time and, as at an auction sale, each individual is prepared to spend only so much on it. Time is the currency of this two-bidder auction. Suppose all such individuals worked out in advance exactly how much time they thought a particular kind of resource, say a female, was worth. A mutant individual who was prepared to go on just a little bit longer would always win. So the strategy of maintaining a fixed bidding limit is unstable. Even if the value of the resource can be very finely estimated, and all individuals bid exactly the right value, the strategy is unstable. Any two individuals bidding according to this maximum strategy would give up at exactly the same instant, and neither would get the resource. It would then pay an individual to give up right at the start, rather than waste any time in contests at all. The important difference between the war of attrition and a real auction sale is, after all, that in the war of attrition, both contestants pay the price, but only one of them gets the goods. In a population of maximum bidders, therefore, a strategy of giving up at the beginning would be successful and would spread through the population. As a consequence of this, some benefit would start to accrue to individuals who did not give up immediately, but waited for a few seconds before giving up. This strategy would pay when played against the immediate retreaters, who now predominate in the population. Selection would then favour a progressive extension of the giving-up time until it once more approached the maximum allowed by the true economic worth of the resource under dispute.
Once again, by using words, we have talked ourselves into picturing an oscillation in a population. Once again, mathematical analysis shows that this is not correct. There is an evolutionarily stable strategy, which can be expressed as a mathematical formula, but in words what it amounts to is this. Each individual goes on for an unpredictable time. Unpredictable on any particular occasion, that is, but averaging the true value of the resource. For example, suppose the resource is really worth 5 minutes of display. At the ESS, any particular individual may go on for more than 5 minutes, or he may go on for less than 5 minutes, or he may even go on for exactly 5 minutes. The important thing is that his opponent has no way of knowing how long he's prepared to persist on this particular occasion. Obviously, it is vitally important in the war of attrition that individuals should give no inkling of when they're going to give up. Anybody who betrayed by the merest flicker of a whisker that he was beginning to think of throwing in the sponge would be at an instant disadvantage. If, say, whisker flickering happened to be a reliable sign that retreat would follow within 1 minute, there would be a very simple winning strategy. If your opponent's whiskers flicker, wait one more minute, regardless of what your own previous plans for giving up might have been. If your opponent's whiskers have not yet flickered, and you are within 1 minute of the time when you intend to give up anyway, give up immediately and don't waste any more time. Never flicker your own whiskers. So natural selection would quickly penalise whisker flickering and any analogous betrayals of future behaviour. The poker face would evolve. Why the poker face rather than out-and-out lies? Once again, because lying is not stable. Suppose it happened to be the case that the majority of individuals raised their hackles only when they were truly intending to go on for a very long time in the war of attrition. The obvious counterploy would evolve. Individuals would give up immediately when an opponent raised his hackles. but now liars might start to evolve. Individuals who really had no intention of going on for a long time would raise their hackles on every occasion and reap the benefits.